So today we're going to talk about Las Quinditas Saludables, or our Healthy Corner Store Network, and how young people through youth organizing planted these seeds of change. So, you know, we start first with the story of Luis. Luis came to us when he was a junior in high school, and he was really worried about his neighborhood. For reference, Luis lives in a small census block called North Fair Oaks in California. It's a high density population of low income Latino immigrants, primarily from Mexico, primarily from Michoacan, primarily from the same town in Michoacan that they all come from. And it was very tight knit. Another problem was there's a high density of corner stores that were really just liquor stores. And when we tried to talk about nutrition and food, a lot of folks in the nutrition world kept asking us, why are you talking about alcohol? And for the young people and the residents, it was a no-brainer. So Luis said, how do we change the story? How do we change the story for my younger brothers and my sister so that they grow up in a community where profit doesn't mean more than people? Where they can go into a corner store and they can get fresh fruits and vegetables instead of being able to buy alcohol and tobacco easily. And so we really looked into what are the foundations of our work. At the heart of our work, we know that change is only possible by using the resources that are the most available to us, which are the young people in the communities. We found that a lot of health workers and folks from county agencies were sending in a brown or Latino face who spoke Spanish, and they weren't getting any buy-in from merchants. Does anyone work for county offices or the government? Is it easy to go into stores and have people trust you? Okay. Sometimes it's a little harder. And we knew that the key was working with actual residents who had the buy-in from the neighborhood. And we knew that no one was more creative than the young people in those neighborhoods. So we wondered, you know, why corner stores? Well, from our data, we know that more than two-thirds of young people go to a corner store once a week. We also know sometimes with data that's skewed because young people lie, so we think it's more than two-thirds of young people who go to corner stores once a week. And the young people are savvy too. We know that when you use populations that are impacted to do the research through participatory action research, it can be pretty empowering. So the young people conducted resident public opinion surveys because they wanted to find out, what do residents really want to buy from stores? At first, merchants said no one wants to buy produce, and we found that they do. A difficulty with this was, what do they want to buy? With the whole buy local, it's a problem if your county is like ours and has a lot of kale, but residents want tomatoes and cilantro. They did observational assessments, and they really looked at, what does the store feel like? Does it feel friendly? Is it dark? Is it closed? Is it someplace that feels safe? And they did merchant pre and post interviews to really look at the satisfaction for the merchants. We know that this work is super easy and you only need one person. I'm being sarcastic. It takes a whole village to raise a child. We know that our core, we need partnership. And so to highlight some of our work, we partnered with the San Mateo County Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, who had never really been able to penetrate this demographic because they always served a higher socioeconomic base of Latino merchants. We partnered in our evaluations both with the Youth Leadership Institute, with our Dr. Jennifer Juris, and with the John Gardner Center for Youth and Communities, because we found that in evaluations of the corner store model, because this model is out there, it's pretty outdated, about 5 or 6 years outdated, and it doesn't take into account to our economic downturn. So if people are going out of business, is it really about the fresh fruits and vegetables, or is it about the economy? We partnered with the sheriff's office to conduct responsible beverage server training, because we knew that if stores don't know how to card young people and they're seen as an easy access point for alcohol and tobacco, then is it really a healthy store? And we partnered with the Second Harvest Food Bank because we knew that if we were to advertise for EBT or food stamps, but no one in the community was signed up for food stamps, who would go to the corner store? So we really had to tackle issues of shame and stigma in the community. This was really important with the migrant education programs in the school, because the majority of the parents in the community were farm workers and had a lot of shame and stigma of their children working in a field that had anything to do with agriculture. So, how do you get a wary merchant to become your ally? What we realized is that merchants are willing to partner with you. They're not the enemy. A secret was that we had to allocate stipends to be a shopper. It means you don't just come in to provide education or drop off forms, but you buy something healthy, maybe a fruit, maybe water each time you go, and you build trust that way. We learned to wait for a signal of trust. Anyone watch that movie, My Big Fat Greek Wedding? Nobody? A little outdated. So in that movie, the protagonist wants to go to college, and she's crying to her mother and says, "My father won't let me go. What do I do?" And she says, "Honey, the man is the head of the household, but the wife is the neck." And we found that you had to find a way to really look at these merchant couples. We found that it was the wife, oftentimes in these small mom and pop stores, could be the deciding factor for when a makeover was really ready. And some merchants in different models, perhaps in a lot of the funded models, require a monetary investment to take some seeds into doing a makeover. We believe in sweat equity. And so in this picture, you'll see Martin Pena actually removing 15 plus alcohol ads that were saturating the cover. And what we did is we scraped off the paint and let light in. And then we replaced those ads with cultural art. And what we found was a guy who was really afraid of violence in the community started to see a lot more business and traffic because it became a friendly place to shop. We know that the store makeover and the launch, it's not as simple as putting in a new refrigeration unit, but it takes a lot of cleaning. And it also takes cleaning our hearts and minds. Part of this was merchant education and produce and promotions, and we found that a lot of the merchants were really nervous about throwing out rotten produce. They didn't understand that it was deterring people from shopping at the store, and without this merchant education, what would be the point of doing a one-time beautification project? Because they would just put those rotten produce back. And we did media advocacy and press work. So what are some of the results? I think one of the bigger results is that we created a corner store network. We realized that stores didn't have to be in competition with one another, that they could work together. So we really wanted to show that change was possible in the community. One of the advantages to this is that they were able to create purchasing power in this one neighborhood by working together to negotiate deals with food distributors. When they saw increased attractiveness of fresh produce, word spread around that, oh, these are the stores who have that blue symbol on their window, and they're most likely to have fresher produce. And we wanted to be able to come up with a replicable model for other communities. We saw a lot of partnering agencies show how to do the actual makeover, but not how do you build trust with merchants and community residents through action research and community organizing. So we developed a toolkit that's available through the Youth Leadership Institute. And so what's the story of Luis? Now Luis is going to college. After some media advocacy on ABC7's local affiliate here in the Bay Area, he had an exclusive internship with Cheryl Jennings. He also went on to become a health educator for Network for Healthy California in elementary schools. And we know that when youth use data-driven action, that they themselves are transformed. So little Gustavo, who tagged along with his little brother, became one of our next youth leaders in our change work. We found out that love was in the details with this cyclical and iterative process. Young people learned new ways to explore participatory action research. So Gustavo helped lead another process where they found out that the number one cause for distracted driving in their neighborhood was eating and driving. they found out that that data was replicated at the state level. So the number one cause of distracted driving in California is eating and driving. So we found that maybe the enemy or the opponent of corner stores aren't other corner stores. Maybe it's the fast food industry. Maybe we need to talk about saturation of that. And we saw that with community organizing, the people that we were worried the most about, the young people in schools where 60 to 70% really depend on free and reduced lunch, become our next generation of health advocates. Thank you. Any questions? Yes. Yeah, so part of it was really looking at, if you look at here, we believe in sweat equity and having them say, what are they going to invest towards the long-term sustainability of the makeover by taking those down? I have to say, we saw this model attempted by other agencies, and when it wasn't utilized with youth leadership, it wasn't effective. Because the young people could say, hey, there's this gigantic tobacco or alcohol ad of a woman in a bikini. What does this send for other 15-year-old girls in the neighborhood? And they were really able to change their practices. We're also able to teach merchants how to use this as a way to advocate for themselves because they were targeted just as aggressively by the bimbo snack cake guy. Any other questions? Yes? So most of the corner store markets are family run. I think what we did see was we saw a next generation of nutrition advocates. As they were working on this, after a few years, they're very primed to be health educators, to work with local WIC offices, or to look at research databases. Yeah. Any other questions?
Great presentation. I'm curious, you mentioned a blue seal that the stores get, if I understand right. Were there any issues related to your county health department having a allowing a seal with certain criteria and so forth? Did you have to go through any process that would signify other kinds of health attributes like the sale of tobacco?
Absolutely. So in the signed agreement, we would always make sure that they're following the LELA, which in California means that no more than 33% of window covering can be covered for the alcohol and tobacco ads. And then we also wanted to make sure that they were following all of the health and safety codes. But we wanted to get them up to that place. Does that help answer your question?
So are those the partnership agreement and available to people
to look at? Yes, we can make that available if you email me. And I think we only have one more question.
Sure. A lot of stores begin were not utilized by community members, correct? Because they were liquor stores or not considered food stores. So how did you know, or how do you know, that it's been actually increased in traffic or actual purchase at these stores with community members? How do you evaluate that?
So we did have post interviews with merchants, and so if you see the picture with Peña Markets in this slide, what happened was we not only taught them how to care for produce, but afterwards when they cleared the blacked out windows, they saw such an increase in business that we had to show them where they can purchase more produce stands. So they doubled their capacity to serve because they were having so much business. That helps. Okay, thank you.
I'd like to thank all of our speakers today for this wonderful presentation, this session. We'd like to open the floor up to other questions and other opportunities to ask questions of any of the speakers here? Yes.
In the emergency market, I saw at the beginning that nutrition education is part of the order. How does that, do you get like a little pop up, like, you know, apple a day, dog away? That had a point of purchase, yeah. So at the point of purchase, what type of nutrition education do you get, and how is it being enforced at the post purchase?
So at point of purchase, we just set up like basically a table that has food demonstration on it. So, as I said, we've been with apples, and we did a whole variety of apples. So not just, people are very used to Granny Smith and Red Delicious, and so we tried every apple. And I actually had a woman, this happened last year when we did apples, she told me she didn't even know there were different types of apples. She thought there were generic brand and name brand apples, and that's the difference in types of them. So we try to do very similar things. We do a lot of one food item modifications. We did peanut butter and jelly for a while, but we just switched to whole wheat bread. Trying to get families just to buy whole grain bread instead of white bread for their kids. I mean, we did salads. We tried to follow some things with My Plate. We did a salad that had every food group in it. So it had beans and mandarin oranges and peas and beans and so and whole wheat croutons. So we covered every area. So we can't do a lot of hot food. We tried using a hot plate for a little while in the library, but we have a lot of little arms that like to reach, and we were got a little too nervous. And so we do a lot of kind of cold food, easy things in the library. So in terms of reinforce at pickup, there's not a ton reinforce at pickup, but every week there is some sort of food demonstration. And what we're trying to do in terms of long-term reinforcing is we partner with the University of Maryland Extension FNET program, and they've come in and done, you know, an 8-week comprehensive nutrition education program that targeted for low-income residents in terms of how to budget, how to make certain food items, how to shop healthfully. So we kind of leave that to them to do that part of it.
Other questions, Chip?
My question is, how do you keep cold food cold?
So alcohol you can't buy at grocery stores in Maryland, so that's already like off the table, so that wasn't hard for us. Tobacco, we just kind of made that a rule at the beginning of the program, and all customers know that there's no tobacco allowed to purchase, and the store wouldn't sell them tobacco. But they can purchase an unintended benefit. Some of our seniors, they get cash back because there's no ATMs in their neighborhoods at all. They get their money orders, they can get stamps, and so they'll get a money order from the grocer, and that way they can pay their bills, and they don't even have to go far. And San Antonio's money order price is much more reasonable than what they could get in their neighborhood at one of those check cash places anyways, and so it really helps. And that's also one of the reasons we have that 1-hour delivery window. Not only has to do with payment, but also perishability of the food. But San Antonio's, if you get milk, ice cream, meat, goes in a freezer bag in a cooler. They are not a large, they're a mom and pop grocer. It's not a very large grocery store. So they don't have, you know, the refrigerated truck like you see with Safeway. It's a van. But even in the middle of the summer, you can still get your ice cream and it still stays cold by their freezer bags and cold packs and things like that. So that's why that 1-hour window works so well.
Other, yes.
So for the virtual supermarket, I can see that the benefit that having all the delivery happen at one location, but in terms of ordering, have you considered smartphones? I saw another talk this morning about low-income communities and their increased use of smartphones, pretty high proportions. Are there any potential advantages, cons to going in that direction?
I think smartphones are definitely the way to go. I mean, I spend most of my time in many of these neighborhoods, and all, like, most of the residents, non-seniors, they all have smartphones. And so I don't think the health department can make the kind of technology advance for San Antonio. That's something that he would kind of need to do. But we have been in talk with some other developers who are looking to maybe create some sort of interactive web app. I will say some of our customers who are tech savvy, they do order just going to like www.santonismarket.com on their smartphone, and it does work. So they can still use their smartphone, but it's not as easy as an application.
Yes. So,
in the convenience stores, you stressed that having youth involved in order to get sign-ups and make things sustainable. Do you have any application you actually got signed up? Is there one you going through the neighborhood, or did you have like 10 or 1?
It depends what neighborhood and how big. This was a one census block. So at any given time, we need at least 68 young people. And we wanted to make sure that they were stopping by at least once every 2 weeks before after school, just to stop in and say, hey, how are you doing, Janet and Ruben? And build that relationship with the merchants more so than our agency. The thing about young people is they're not youth forever, so you have to keep recruiting and replenishing as they get a little old.
Other, yes.
As you know, the food co-op movement is growing, and towards the end of our program, we have just completed finance about 2 or 3 food member-owned food cooperatives. There's an organization called the Rural Grocers Initiative, and they specifically target communities of 2,500 or less in population. They're headquartered at Kansas State University. They have on their website, you can just say Rural Grocery Initiative, a number of models, and they do tend to be community-created models. There's examples, for example, where high schools actually create, as part of education curriculum, grocery stores, which students in the community run, and then they partner with a business to go get the big challenge in rural areas sometimes is getting the product to the location. So on that webpage, there are a number of innovations that you can read about with smaller communities or communities that are in isolated community places.
Other questions? Take number.
Reinvestment Fund has, for the past year, been looking into what we call food system infrastructure, the capital needs and finance needs, and what are the impediments. So I'm not an expert on that area. There are CDFIs who specialize in farm-related work. One is called the Carrot Project, that's based in Massachusetts. And also, if you're going to go on to slides in CDFI Fund, which is part of the Treasury Department. There was a capacity building initiative, and you'll find a series of webinars that talk about projects that are focused on financing, I think if you say, socially, economically disadvantaged farmers, minority farmers, or farmers that are trying to enter into local food systems work. So there is a vast resource. We just don't have a lot of our own direct experience at this point in time. Hopefully, I'll be back in a year or two and we can talk about some of our efforts. We've done a lot with aggregators and food hubs, people who buy from local farmers. Green Grow is a Philadelphia urban farm that's also registered TSA, but they're also an aggregator. And you work with them to support them, and they purchase from like 60 local farmers.
Other?
So
yes.
I did want to add to that question. So our first model was actually piloted in Central Valley, California, where most of the produce is grown in California. And unfortunately, the people who work the land don't get to eat this produce because it's shipped off everywhere else. So our first partnership was funded by the California Endowment, which was mentioned in the first presentation, and actually sourced these local ethnic farmers to come and teach these
merchants how to care for produce and shipping their wares directly to the stores, and hiring farmers as consultants for best practice. So there's a lot of that in the works.
One of the things that other agriculture clubs are doing is they're trying to get tobacco and tobacco products out of the disadvantaged neighborhoods. And for many small retailers and local retailers, tobacco is one of the prime revenue and profit markets. I was just wondering if you've worked on any business models or other case studies to see if are there opportunities there for retailers to survive without selling.
Yes. Yes, actually we have in our signed agreements that for the store makeovers, we want the responsible sales of alcohol, but no sales of tobacco for our merchants to receive this makeover process and the free refrigeration units. And we found that it's actually advantageous to their business with a public health model that we are utilizing. For the local lead agencies who are taking on this work, we're finding with our assessments that are going to happen all across the state, in our state in California, that there has been a direct correlation with the stores that have the most tobacco ads had the least access to fresh produce. And we're showing that you can make much more profit by selling what's healthy and making it easy.
Other questions? Can I just take one from someone who hasn't been? Well, then we'll do you.
Go on. Really, I just want to hear your guidance. One question for Jennifer Dean, and the youth who are involved with
Katrina, sorry. You know, I have a pretty controversial stance on stipends. It's not the most popular. We offer scholarships. And I think what's more important in our partnership, because the Youth Leadership Institute also has a partnership with the White House for connecting young people with opportunities who are disconnected from education and a workforce right now, is that we build a workforce. We build skills for young people so that they're not just working in the corner stores, but they have professional careers and a pathway towards that. So I think that is something that we're really trying to move towards with our model. But yes, we do give scholarships for their work, but much more so we want to work towards a workforce development model.
Do you have a question?
Yes, I'm from Texas, where urban sprawl has taken a big impact out in the suburbs, and gentrification has taken place in the city. Plus, I know that in those rural, from the new suburban areas, there are not food, there are still food deserts. Are there ways to incentivize the mom and pop or other types of groceries into those areas? Because the only one that's even looking at them are the large chains, and they're not particularly interested because they really do not have enough rooftops to do their work to go in there. So how do you, are there any efforts on how do you address those in the suburban areas where things occur?
I think the key is finding an entrepreneurial independent grocer who's looking to grow their business. And once you find them, and the financing package can help them to overcome some of their startup costs. One of the advantages that you found that independent or entrepreneurial-minded grocers have over your super centers and your chain is that they're in a better position to respond to market quicker and much quickly as opposed to the cookie cutter approach, and that's their competitive advantage. Sometimes they're not, you can find them in surprising places. There is a trade association nationally called the National Grocers Association, and they actually represent the independent grocers. I mean, I think, we always think of the big brand names, and that's when you think of supermarkets, but there are a lot of family-owned businesses, sometimes they're generational. Out there, and so it's just a question of uncovering them. So I would encourage you to, National Grocers Association often has chapters in different states, to reach out to them and say, who are your independent grocers in Texas? We think we have great opportunities in this community, Can we, talk with them about it? Another thing we learned, and it's probably true like even with your corner store operators, sometimes it's not the public official talking to the grocer, but if you can get someone like Jeff Brown, who's successful, he now has an organization where he'll go out and talk to other grocers and say, yes, you know, working in underserved communities, running a business, you can do it well, provide quality service, and still turn a profit. Sometimes you hear it better from your colleagues and peers than from someone else, you know, a government official or like. So that's another way, though, you know, getting another grocer to say, yes, I've done this, I was successful.
So we're acutely sensitive of gentrification in our communities, and we really want to move beyond beautification and really look at a public policy lens for this. And so what we've had success with is partnering with cities to teach them how to include a health section into their general plan. And so the young people we work with include a health section to the North Fair Oaks general plan, and with that incentivize local stores who were qualified as healthy neighborhood stores to have incentives and protections against larger corporations coming in, because we are sensitive to communities like the Mission District in San Francisco or the Tenderloin, where big corporations can come in and shut down these small businesses. So general plans are usually the best way to get that kind of work underway.
Other questions? Yes.
In particular, a lot of disadvantaged communities, rates of diabetes, hypertension, cholesterol, kidney disease are, of course, high and getting higher. Did you observe in your participants, direct interest in eating food that's appropriate for, their chronic diseases? Is that something that came into play with the consumer's hand, if you will, and how they interacted with the people selling food?
The publication Grocery Gap is a summary of about 100 studies that show if you improve access to healthier foods, whether it's through a corner store or a supermarket, that the community responds, and you're starting to see correlations in terms of what they're choosing to eat. We have those types of studies. We have the anecdotes from our grocers who say, those loyalty cards tell you a lot of information, when you get your discount. And so they say without question, fresh produce sales are significantly higher. And those who also have, suburban stores say, sometimes eating in suburban stores. What's the difference is that in Philadelphia, community may be buying collard greens as opposed to kale, or sweet potatoes as opposed to white potatoes, things like that, that are more culturally connected to that community. So we have those stories, we have data that there's impact and change. And also grocers are now, who are engaged in this work, they too get excited and enthusiastic and begin to innovate around how they can begin to do a better job of promoting healthy eating habits. The grocer who the First Lady visited is one of our best advocates and has instituted a number of in-store marketing promotion things for like his Healthy Kids Corner. So once people kind of get it, it's exciting to see them then take it to the next level on their own.
Yeah, we also help people if they say, I have diabetes, I need to watch my sugar. We can go through, and what's nice about San Antonio's website is you can read the label. And so we can help people read the labels right there to say, it still has a lot of sugar in it. You might want to look for another item. Let's see what else we can help find for you. And so we definitely do some of that kind of point of sale direct help. We're not going to prevent people from getting something that they want, but we definitely nudge them a little bit to make some of these healthier food choices. And it's definitely more prevalent. We're starting to work with the local community health centers in the area to have them send their customers over to the virtual supermarket where they can get direct one-on-one help in ordering their groceries.
I think what's been helpful for us is really changing the frame of our conversation. I think a lot of times healthy food has been seen as very new age. And we want to frame that this is not new age, this is the old ways. Coconut water might be trendy, but for Mitchell Kahn, the last store makeover, really catered to a Pacific Islander community. So eating a coconut, very normal. It's not new age. And so we'd show that by increasing the amount of coconut and having machetes available where people can go to the store and have that on a hot day, it increased the amount of really sexy, interesting non-sugar sweetened beverages that you can have available.
Other questions? Yes, in the back.
Yeah, definitely. So we presented to the RAB board, which is our resident advisory group. So basically all the public housing developments in Baltimore have monthly meetings. And so our community health organizer and I presented to them, and we gave them the overview of the program. And what we kind of lifted up to them is said, invite us back. And then if for the neighborhoods that we're in, so we came, gave a presentation in their community, and then we kind of really leave it up to them then to, we help them. We give a lot of handholding to help form a group of the neighborhood food advocates. And then once that group is formed, we really work closely with them on technical assistance training. What things do you want the virtual supermarket? What flyers do you want? What do you want them to look like to really make it direct for their community? And for our senior buildings, a lot just has to do with, are you in a food desert area? One of our other virtual supermarket customers did it for us. She walked over to a senior building and was like, I think you should be here. She went over, she made the connection, and she brought us to that site. So it's a little bit a mix. It's also, people hear about it in Baltimore, and they call us and say, we want this here. So then we meet with them to really gauge, to really see if there is true community interest.
Other questions? I think there was a question here.
Antonio's, our grocer that we work with, they have like rotisserie chicken, right? But they have them, they make the rotisserie chicken, but instead of keeping them in the hot section, they put them in the refrigerator section. So they're no longer hot. They have to cool them, but they are prepared food. And you can put a different UPC code on them because it's a cold food, and then you can buy it with your EBT. So you can, they do that for some of their like not healthy foods, like chicken tenders and mashed potatoes that they have hot in the store. They'll already prepare them, put them out, and then put them in their cooler section and slap another label on it. So that's how the store we work with gets around that.
You know, actually we work on a different model, and one of it is we really wanted to say, how can the corner store model be about the slow food movement? And how can we teach stores the product placement that Whole Foods would have? So that items such as tomatoes and guacamole are placed next to each other, so then you can cook at home, and then teaching the local Latino parents that young people and their families that cook and eat a meal together at home are more likely to have children with less suicidal tendencies, gang violence, alcohol, tobacco and drug use, and better performance in schools. So we really encourage cooking at home with families. Luis is one of our best health educators now.
Yeah. There's an example in Philadelphia on Corner Store Network where food trucks purchased refrigerated barrels, and then they took fruit to cut it up into smaller packages. First they did it, and then they trained an operator who now does it. And those fruit cups are priced at about what the same price that a bag of chips would cost. So, you know, whatever that is, but it's connected to their food education nutrition program. So, you know, we funded the purchase of the refrigerated barrel that sits in a prominent location with great signage, and price-wise, it's the same as if the child were to go in and get nuts and chips.
Other questions or comments? I'd really like to thank our speakers again for such an informative and action-oriented presentation for all of us. And I'm sure speak to them when I say they are open to comment and questions after the session as well. Thank you very much.